Lecture 47, Psychological and Biological Determinism.
Behaviorism, psychoanalytic theory, genetic psychology, the brain sciences, contextual factors in determining altruistic behavior. Psychoanalytic theory by way of Freud, Piagetian stage theories of cognitive development. What have all these in common? What seems to be at the bottom, the sort of the metaphysical foundations of these schools and systems and perspectives on psychology? Well, some have recognized at the very foundation of these schools and systems nothing less than a deterministic psychology, a deterministic metaphysics. Is it the case that the most significant manifestations of our psychological nature are intelligence, personality, social interactions, development, problem solving, attitudes toward life and toward each other, are finally in the thrall either of a reinforcement history via Skinnerian psychology, or an evolutionary process via Freudian psychoanalytic and psychodynamic ontogenesis, or through the demand characteristics of a situation as these are finally perceived by a socio-biologically shaped organism and the like? It's an interesting range of questions. It's part of the long debate. In fact, I'd be inclined to say it might be the central component of the long debate. Free will versus determinism. Philosophy 101. Did Kant get it right? Is Skinner really, or might Freud be a more reliable god? And, of course, anyone who thinks that that issue is going to be resolved in this lecture or by me, or by me cloned into 12 of me, then this would be a good time to turn to some other pursuit. But I think it is possible to get some clarity on the nature of the issue and to find oneself less frequently in blind alleys or deluded by the tricks and arts that we play on ourselves propositionally and by way of language and by way of mere prejudices. Well, what does determinism entail? What do we mean when we say that an event is determined, that any event is determined? What do we mean when we say that an object falls toward the center of the earth because it is determined to by the laws of gravity? Now, how could a law of gravity determine anything? What do we mean by a law of gravity? Usually what we mean when we talk about the laws of science is not a knowledge of what actually is causing the thing that we're perceiving, but rather the rule by which that hidden cause operates. And I want to say this again. I might even want to say it two or three different ways. I want to distinguish between the actual causes of things and the laws or rules that we discover that describe the way causes operate. So let me go back to the textbook example of falling objects. One holds up an eraser or a piece of chalk and lets it go, and it falls toward the center of the earth. And if we measure it very carefully, we discover something like this, that it falls at a rate somehow proportioned to its mass and the estimated mass of the earth, inversely proportional to the distance between it and the gravitational center of the earth. And we say, aha, thanks to Newton, we knew this was going to happen. We even knew by what degree it was going to happen and the like. Now, but then someone stands up, not to be churlish or skeptical, but someone stands up with a quite innocent and correct question and says, look, you've stated a universal law of gravitation, which describes fairly accurately now what this object did. But why does it fall toward the center of the earth? And indeed, why does it fall in a manner proportioned to its mass and et cetera, et cetera? Why doesn't it fall some other way? And of course, there you don't have an answer. You don't have an answer as to just what gravity is in that elemental ontological sense of something being a pen or a pair of glasses and the like, something you can point to, something you can hold up. So it's one thing to say that we have a very developed knowledge of the causal laws that cover the physical realm. It's quite another thing to say that we know the causes themselves. There's a difference between knowing the rule by which a cause operates and knowing the cause itself. Well, this raises yet another question. How do we ever arrive at a notion like causal determinism? I would ask those within the range of this lecture to just stop for a moment and ask what it is you'd have to know, what kind of being you would have to be, what kind of cognitive or mental process would have to be present for one to reach the conclusion that events in the external world are related by way of causality, that A actually caused B. There's a very, very famous theory about the manner in which we form concepts of causation. It's a theory developed in the 18th century by David Hume. It's sometimes referred to as the regularity theory or the constant conjunction theory. Hume, of course, wants to reduce the most complex aspects of our cognitive life to an experiential history. Hume is a central figure in the history of empiricistic philosophy. And what he specifically wants to reject is the proposition that we have innate knowledge that predates experience, authorizes it, a product of rationality, something sort of a deus ex machina, entity that fills up the mind as needed, and he wants to show that the concept of causation is based just on the kinds of experiences that all of our knowledge is based on. And so what he argues is this: we reach the conclusion that A is the cause of B when A and B have been constantly conjoined in experience. So if in fact A takes place, and at some interval later, B reliably takes place, regularly takes place, hence the regularity theory, regularly takes place, it is a veritable habit of the mind to reach the conclusion that A is the cause of B. So whenever A and B are constantly conjoined in experience, whenever B reliably succeeds A, and there are other features to Hume's theory, particularly A and B enjoying some degree of similarity. But when similarity and contiguity and constant conjunction have been established in the realm of experience, we inevitably, habitually, reach the conclusion that A is the cause of B. In fact, so inclined are we to make that causal attribution, says Hume, that, quote, anything may be the cause of anything, close quote. And what he means by that is, if the world had been contingently constituted in such a way that every time I raised my hand, there was a loud sound in the corner of the room, inevitably I would reach the conclusion that my raising my hand causes a sound to be produced. It might be a purely coincidental event, but if it does have this reliability in experience, this regularity in experience, constant conjunction, contiguity in space and time, the mind insensibly is led to the conclusion that the antecedent event caused the latter event. Now, on that Humean account, then, when science engages in the search for causal laws, what it's searching for, really, are statistical regularities and reliabilities. Thus, when we say that there are laws of gravity or laws of conservation, conservation of mass and the like, what we're saying is when we actually set out to measure these things and set them up, there will be a constant conjunction of antecedent and consequent events. This will take a form that lends itself to a mathematical description. The mathematical description finally is just what we mean by the law of science. Now, I think anyone hearing Hume's account for the first time not only finds in it preeminently good and common sense, but the sort of sense that matches up very well with our own experiences. It seems to be faultless, and so with a kind of shrug we say that's the end of the story. We arrive at the concept of causation as a result of our daily experiences in the world, and thus we may surely be misled by what merely are correlations into concluding that there's a causal relationship here, but it's a habit of the mind. And given that it's a habit of the mind, and here Hume's program gets very close to heresy, since it is a habit of the mind to refer to God as the cause of all things, etc., etc., well, this is certainly not going to match up with Hume's requirements for establishing causal relationships, because you didn't see this happen, there isn't a constant conjunction. So what you mean when you make these ascriptions to God as being the ultimate cause of things is you're just filling in the gaps where a causal account must operate. And of course, Hume's difficulties with established belief here are of legendary proportions. Well, is this an adequate account of the basis upon which we come to discover causes or come to have causal concepts? Hume's most influential contemporary critic was the alleged father of Scottish common sense philosophy. Until you start parsing sentences like that, it's not quite clear what you're charging him with. But the redoubtable Scot Thomas Reid, who taught for many years at the University of Aberdeen and concluded his academic life taking over on the retirement of Adam Smith at the University of Glasgow, a preeminent philosopher, and one who has more recently engaged the attention of contemporary philosophers and intellectual historians, a main figure, an important person in his time, and an important person for the better part of a century following his death. Now, Thomas Reid's most successful critique of David Hume, Reid put together two very, very large works toward the end of his long life. But in 1764, he had published his An Inquiry into the Human Mind, and I think this is still one of the clearest and most cogent 200-plus pages of analytical philosophy composed in the English language. It's quite the tour de force. It's very amusingly written in places and powerfully discerning in other places. But on this matter of causation, Reid makes this quite interesting observation. How could you ever conclude from the mere perception of external regularities, not just that there were external regularities, but that one of the events in that regular sequence causally determined the other? That is, in what would that concept be grounded? And Reid is fairly confident that he has the answer. Unless you recognized yourself as having causal powers, that is, unless on the basis of your own internal psychology, so to speak, you recognized that it was possible to bring an event about, there would be no basis upon which to assume, from the mere regular coincidence of external events, that one was the cause of the other. Reid says, for example, on the notion of constant conjunction, no two events have ever been as constantly conjoined as day and night, and yet no man come of years thinks that day is the cause of night, or night is the cause of day. So the mere conjunction of events does not unfailingly lead us to the conclusion that one caused the other. Smith, to use a macabre example, Smith doesn't have to repeatedly shoot and kill Jones some number of times, finally to reach the conclusion that Smith just may be the cause of Jones' demise. Smith recognizes himself as having what Thomas Reid calls active power. And the difference between active power and causation is this. Given a cause, there must be an effect. There are no causes without effects. There are no effects without causes. But an active power is something different. An active power is something that not only can be deployed, but it can be withheld. To have an active power, then, is to be not only to be able to do something, but to forbear from doing something. And as Reid notes, this is the basis upon which we can be held morally answerable for our actions. If our actions were simply causally determined by antecedents, then we would be no more responsible for what we do than a ball is when it rolls down an inclined plane. But it is in virtue of our having active power, not only the ability to go bang bang, but the ability not to do that, the ability to withhold the deployment of our powers, that constitutes us as members of a moral realm. Now, I want to stay for a moment on Reid's critique of Hume's theory of causation. In fact, Hume himself says in his famous treatise of 1739, Treatise of Human Nature, he notes that many features of his philosophy were composed by him in the privacy of his own study, because some of the conclusions that he reaches are counterintuitive, and that he, like so many other people, once he stepped into the light of day, reverted to the more common understandings in this regard. Well, of course, when Reid gets to this part of the treatise, and he's deeply respectful of David Hume, but when he gets to this part of the treatise, he says of Hume's admission here, He says, we learned from Mr. Hume that he could only attach himself to his own philosophy in the privacy of his study. He said, so that his views then are very much like a hobby horse, which a man, when he is ill, can keep at home and ride to his own contentment. But should he ever bring it into the marketplace, his friends would quickly impanel a jury and confiscate his estates. Reid here is being playful. In fact, if I might just spend a moment on this wonderful Enlightenment debate. Thomas Reid wanted Hume to read The Inquiry before it was published. He wanted to make sure that he got Hume right. And after all, it is a quite two-fisted critique, and Hume was a figure that Thomas Reid deeply respected. They did have a friend in common, Hugh Blair, and Reid implored Blair to get Hume to read it. Blair sends it off. Hume returns it unwrapped, saying that it's always been my view that ministers should spend, Reid was a Presbyterian minister, ministers should spend their time bothering each other and should leave philosophy to philosophers. It's a rather high-handed, dismissive sort of thing. Well, Blair writes back and says, look, I think you better read this. We're not just talking about some Presbyterian divine. This is some pretty powerful smoke. You better go through this, blah, blah, blah. Well, Hume does read it, and he's deeply admiring of it, and he writes an extremely gracious, appreciative, and quite sincere letter back to Thomas Reid, indicating that Reid's critique has caused him to rethink any number of his positions. And Reid writes to Hume one of these wonderful Enlightenment-type letters, which concludes, this is very nearly a complete quote, he concludes, "And although we here at Aberdeen, sir, are all good Christian men, we would prefer your company to that of St. Athanasius himself. And I fear if you were to write no further in metaphysics, we would have nothing to talk about at all." Well, this is the way titanic struggles in the Enlightenment were waged by members of the intellectual community who might have set a good example for us all. What Reid is getting at, and what so much of philosophy gets at, is that there cannot be a moral realm unless there is some sensible, defensible ground on which to hold persons responsible. The ground on which to hold a person responsible is the ground that the action in question could have been otherwise. Not only could it have been otherwise, but it could have been otherwise through the application of the active power of the individual himself or herself. That where that condition is not satisfied, moral attributions are simply wrong. To hold somebody responsible for what is otherwise inevitable, for what is otherwise causally determined, for what otherwise falls beyond the powers of that person or perhaps any person, is simply to misunderstand what moral blameworthiness is all about. It is about actions that could have been otherwise. Now, understood that way, we can define determinism. At least we can specify what a deterministic psychology asserts. Determinism in the metaphysical sense asserts this. Given the initial conditions and given the laws that govern everything, whatever happens couldn't be otherwise. That is the rigid deterministic thesis, is this. Whatever happens, given the prevailing conditions and the causal laws that constitute the glue of the universe, couldn't be different from what it is. Now, if you apply that hard deterministic thesis to the human condition, what it would say is, what that thesis would say in the matter of our lives, would be the following. Given the initial conditions, what would the initial conditions be? Our overall neurobiology, the laws that govern the neurochemistry and physiology of the nervous system and the body in general, the conditioning history to which we've been exposed, the hereditary or genetic substrate on which these physiological processes depend, and which constitute the very template for these physiological mechanisms and processes. Given our sensitivity to the physical environment, and indeed to what we come to call the social environment, which is just a pattern of stimuli of a certain kind, given all that, given the circumstances, what I now do could not be otherwise. That is, what I now do is the last term in a series of events that indeed is a causal series culminating in this event. It might even include my thinking that I'm doing this volitionally, but in fact that very thought itself would be obeisant to causal laws inextricably bound up with language, language acquisition, etc., etc. Well, what then is the fate of moral discourse on the assumption that whatever I or anyone else does couldn't be different from what it turns out to be because of determinism? Now, some have argued that, the moral realm remains fairly well in place. We can accept that everything we do is causally determined in the sense in which I just described. But within that overall framework of causal determinism, it's possible compatibly to put together a form of moral discourse in which we nonetheless do hold ourselves responsible, but indeed we recognize that responsibility here is not grounded in that full, free moral autonomy of the Kantian variety. It's something that and then the sentences trail off. There's a thick literature under the general heading of compatibilism, which would want to make clear that viewed in a certain light, a deterministic psychology is compatible with a voluntaristic psychology. I must plead ignorance here, for I've never been able to see how those arguments actually succeed, and as they've been advanced by some fairly formidable figures in philosophy, I gather that the deficiency is mine. You might consult this literature and discover that your deficiencies and mine are quite kindred, which may establish that indeed we're genetically related to a greater extent than we might have thought. Now, one might ask the question, what kind of a thesis is the deterministic thesis? Are we to understand this as, let's say, is it a scientific hypothesis? Now, is it a scientific hypothesis, or is it what might be called part of an overarching worldview, what in the German of old was called a Weltanschauung? Is it just one way of seeing the world of possibilities? Of all the choices that I've got, the one that makes most sense to me is a rigidly deterministic framework. There can't be any exceptions to this, and that means that the realm of human conduct and human life has to be fit into it, even if it means tucking and cutting and squeezing and the like. The alternative to that is to assume, As Voltaire said at one point, Voltaire says that all the heavens, that the very cosmos itself, should be governed by fixed eternal laws, and that there should be a little creature 5 feet tall, acting solely according to his own caprice, is ridiculous on its face. Well, is it ridiculous on its face that even if the whole cosmos is governed by fixed eternal laws, there should be a creature 5 feet tall that says, not a way to go, cosmos, but I'm going this way? Well, I mean, I say from the fact that we can think it, there might be some evidence to the effect that it is so, that how, after all, could we think freedom if, in fact, it matched up with nothing about us? Freedom, on Reed's account, the notion of having an active power, he believes, begins very, very early on. It may begin ultimately early on, but if you take a look at the situation of an infant, imagine the infant in the crib. The infant in the crib holds up a hand. As that hand is moved toward the face, it gets larger. As it moves away from the face, it gets smaller. There's a perfect correlation now between what this infant does and what the external perceptible world is doing. It couldn't possibly take much of this before it dawns on the infant that his doings actually have consequences, and his doings are his doings because he's initiating them. Reed wants to say that from this growing sense of oneself as having active power, we then impute to the external world similar arrangements so that he turns the table on Hume. What he says is the way you develop a concept of causation is by beginning with your own sense of yourself as an agent with active powers and then attributing to the purely material world some similar kind of process or mechanism. But if you didn't have this at the level of your own psychology, you would never be able to arrive at the concept of an external world involving causal interactions. Well, I say, what kind of a thesis is this deterministic thesis? Is it a scientific thesis? If it's a scientific thesis, then presumably there's some imaginable experiment that would confirm or refute it, support or raise questions about it. Well, what kind of experiment might that be? I should think it would be an experiment in which one would have to discover whether the motives that initiate movement are authentic motives of the actors versus motives that have been supplied by heredity, psychosexual stages of development, conditioning history, contextual factors. That is, we want to distinguish between authentic motives, meaning that Smith is moved to do X because of something uniquely Smith's, namely Smith's unique volitions, Smith's desire, authentic desire, not something programmed in under hypnosis or some narcotic or during sleep or because he always got M&Ms when he did this sort of thing. No, no, this is authentically Smith's own versus Smith doing what he's doing because of all of these other determining influences, do you see? Well, how might an experiment like that proceed? You certainly can't start at the outset by assuming that Smith, even in answering these questions, is utterly determined to give the answer that he does. Because if you assume a priori that even in answering your questions, Smith is reading out the deterministic history of a lifetime, then the experiment's impossible. That is, the experiment is inconceivable, except on the proposition that there might be at least one occasion in which Smith can answer truly, which is to say, Smith can give an answer that is otherwise not causally determined by all of the things leading up to that utterance. But of course, if you grant that Smith is able to do that, then you've defeated the deterministic thesis, because in fact you now have found at least one setting in which Smith authentically can serve up a reply that was not itself causally determined. Now I say, I don't want to stretch this out too far. I'd like to leave you with at least this whimsical possibility, and it might even be, I shouldn't say it would be in any sense profound. I'd rather think of it as whimsical. It may be profound, but that is, if determinism is testable, it's false. Well, how intriguing that might be. Then we raise this question. Suppose determinism in some sense is true. Would it matter? Which is quite an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, you might say, at first blush, well, of course it would matter. That's the end of courts, it's the end of trials, it's the end of praise and blame. Remember B.F. Skinner's Beyond Freedom and Dignity, no praise, no blame, you know, it's all in the reinforcement history. Well, I think if you think about it a little further, you discover, no, that really wouldn't happen at all. Suppose you find yourself engaged in a debate with a radical, extreme determinist. Now, there's something quite interesting about debating a radical extreme determinist. Why is he doing this, is the question. Well, of course, on his own metaphysical assumptions, it is determined that he's going to be advancing this thesis. On his own metaphysical assumptions, it is determined whether or not you're going to accept or reject this thesis. So the question then becomes why he is appealing to your reason. In fact, why there's an argument at all. It's obviously foreordained. If determinism is true, then the position he takes in defending it and you take in opposing it already is determined. In fact, when the defendant now looks to the jury box and says, "You have found me guilty, but don't you realize that it was determined that I would do what I did? It was determined that you would view the evidence as you did. Therefore, it was determined that you reached the verdict that you reached. The whole thing is determined." The jurors probably would look at each other and say, "Well, that's probably why we found this character guilty." The point being that a radical determinism, ironically, leaves everything as it was before you accepted a radical determinism. Nothing has changed. Whether or not you accept the thesis has been determined. How you oppose the thesis, the institutions that you end up with, the laws that you put in place, that you enact, the punishments that you exact, the praise and blame that you extend. Well, I should want to say that if there are two views about the full dimensions of human and animal psychology, whether or not we have in complex organisms the possibility of inventiveness and originality and the taking of initiatives, all these things played out in some mysterious way within the arenas of thought and feeling, or whether the whole thing is really just a complex version of balls rolling down an inclined plane, neither of those alternatives will ever be vindicated in a laboratory or by a law of science. So pick the narrative that allows your own life to make the greatest sense or the greater sense. Speaking only for myself, the idea that I bring at least some things about that were not anticipated by a causal series makes more sense.